Sox host Cleveland again at Comiskey. NHL playoffs. The Blackhawks meet the Anaheim Ducks in Game 2 of their Western Conference Stanley Cup Finals Series tonight in Anaheim. Ducks up 1-0. The forecast now from the National Weather Service. Cloudy, breezy, and cool this morning. Partly sunny for the afternoon. High of 56. Right now, winds from the northwest at 13. 48 degrees, Racine and Kenosha. 45 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Speaking for the next. I am profoundly honored to be speaking for the next few minutes with one of America's truly outstanding writers. His name is Ralph Peters. He is a best-selling author several times over. Happens to be a retired U.S. Army officer and former enlisted man. And someone who is a fervent student of history and someone who cares very much about our country. He has written both fiction and nonfiction about America's Civil War. Some of his books under his own name of Ralph Peters and also under the pen name of Owen Perry. He's won all kinds of different awards for his writing. And perhaps you know some of his previous novels also published by Forge, such as Cain at Gettysburg, Hell or Richmond, The Officers' Club, and The War After Armageddon. This new novel, also published by Forge, is called Valley of the Shadow. And Ralph Peters, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thank you so much for having me on. It means a lot.
And I appreciate this opportunity to talk with someone whose work I really admire. And this particular novel, Valley of the Shadow, is a really superb work. It is, of course, what I think is referred to as a historical novel, very much rooted in history, populated to a large extent by people who actually lived in the pages of history. And some of the names we know very well, including men who would go on to become president of the United States, but we are meeting them at a time years before that occurs, and of course also populated by men whose names we do not know. But it's such an intriguing genre. I wonder if you could just say a word about the pleasures, the challenges of writing these kind of novels, designed to bring our own history alive, but in a way different from the way a work of nonfiction would.
Well, one of the problems with historical fiction is it's got such a bad reputation, because frankly, too much of it is hysterical fiction, or more fiction than history, and a lot of it is candy-coated, romanticized, even politically correct. And what I'm striving to do is really, we don't have the term, you know, that we have to categorize everything. So it's categorized as historical fiction. To me, it's dramatized history, because I am literally obsessed with getting every detail right. You know, not just the weather that day, but the weather at a given time of day. Was it wheat or rye in that field? What kind of hat did that particular officer wear? And it may seem, you know, a bit mad, but to me, if you get the details all right, the environment of the past, the atmosphere of the past, emerges almost magically. And so while you don't want to burden the reader with details, you have to be selective in their use. You have to know them. And so what I'm trying to do, and it's an ambitious goal, but you have to have ambitious goals in life, I think. My goal is to write the most authentic historical novels possible. So these books, except for Cain at Gettysburg, a few of the enlisted characters were composites. But in this book, The Valley of the Shadow, about the fighting in the Shenandoah Valley in 1864, dramatic, decisive fighting, every character is a historical figure. They're based upon their letters home, letters to them, their diaries, their official reports, their memoirs, as well as some superb research done by modern historians. And I don't want to slight them either. But people ask me, how long did it take you to write Valley of the Shadow? And the answer is over half a century. Because I was grew up in the late 50s and 60s during the centennial of the Civil War. Seems so long ago now. And I was fascinated. I was captivated. And I wrote my first book on the Civil War when I was in seventh grade, almost published by Scribner's, a blessing that it wasn't because it was pretty bad, but they saw it as a novelty item, you know, Civil War history by this kid. But it's been an interest of mine all my life. I'm not a golfer. This is my vice, as it were. And so it took me a long time to feel confident enough to write these books. You know, I served as an enlisted man, as a career officer, which helped immeasurably in understanding soldiers, of course, and how things really happen. I mean, oftentimes historians will ask, well, why didn't General X do this? It's obvious. Well, General X might have not have slept for 3 days. He might have had diarrhea or toothache. His soldiers were exhausted. The food hadn't, you know, the rations hadn't been delivered. You learn as a sergeant or a junior officer how hard it is to get a squad of 10 or a dozen men up when they're cold and wet in the middle of the night and get them moving. Well, how much harder is it to get 12,000 men up or 120,000 men and get them moving? So I think my military service taught me how hard things can be. And Clausewitz said that in war, everything is simple, but the simplest things are very, very hard. And that aphorism has a lot of truth in it. So at any rate, what am I trying to do with historical fiction? To make it historically accurate, because I have a secret agenda. And that agenda is to reacquaint Americans with a history we've forgotten. I want to get it as accurately as possible, and I want to move beyond the most famous names, which all we remember now, Lee, Grant, Stonewall, Jackson, Jeb Stuart, Sherman, or the big battles, and talk about the incredible drama of this continent-spanning war that really shaped the next 150 years, and is still shaping things today. There are still unresolved issues. So Valley of the Shadow is, I like to think it's an enjoyable read. It's, you know, full of battles and fascinating characters, but it's also good history.
Mm, it certainly is. And you've actually inadvertently begun to answer my next question, which is, why the Civil War? Why is it that has galvanized your energies and for such a long time, as opposed to some other great conflict in our history, which might have at least comparable, if not maybe equal, significance? Did anything in particular draw you to the Civil War and continue to fuel your fascination over all these decades?
Well, I could give you many reasons. First of all, intellectually, it's the 4 years when war becomes modern. 1861, it's still old-fashioned Napoleonic warfare. By 1864, it's a preview of World War I. I could tell you, honestly, that, you know, my father and mother, at least once, usually twice a year, would drive us 3 hours to Gettysburg, and it took that long before the interstates came in, and we'd crawl over the cannons and try, and my dad would try to explain the battle to us and see the old Gettysburg electric map. I could tell you, because I'm fascinated by the characters, and it's true I am. But, you know, at the end of the day, you can't, how can we explain the things that fascinate or obsess us? It's like trying to explain why you fall in love with the person you fall in love with. You may have a checklist on what you're looking for in a spouse or a boyfriend or girlfriend, and yet this magic person comes along who doesn't match the checklist at all, and they captivate you. And in the same ineffable way, I think that for me, the Civil War in my childhood captured me and never let go. And it's full of great stories. I mean, that's frustrating because there are so many stories still untold about the Civil War or forgotten, and we keep obsessing about the same handful of battles and characters. And so in this one, in the Valley of the Shadow, the new novel, it opens with this almost forgotten Confederate raid in toward Washington late in the war that comes literally within an hour of seizing Washington, D.C. It's prevented, this daring sneak raid with 18,000 men, totally missed by the Union spies and agents and commanders. One lone general in disfavor in a rear area posting in Baltimore has virtually no troops, Lew Wallace, who after the war will write Ben-Hur and have an illustrious career, but he's in the doghouse for political reasons. And yet he's the one guy that's reading the telegraphic messages from the railroads, and the Confederates are burning tracks and stations and rolling stock as they come along, and he realizes this is serious, and it's Jubal Early, General Jubal Early, and they're headed either for Baltimore or Washington, and he bets it's going to be Washington. So Lew Wallace can't convince anybody of this on his own authority and exceeding his authority. He rounds up what today we'd call the clerks and jerks. He gets invalids, militiamen, finally gets some regular troops as reinforcements, not many at the end. And he makes a stand on the Monocacy River just south of Frederick, Maryland. He's outnumbered 3.5 or 4 to 1 by real hard-bitten Confederate veterans. He knows he's going to lose, but he has to buy time for the Union reinforcements to arrive. And he fights a desperate battle, desperate. And he loses. He knows he's going to lose, but he buys a day for the Union. As a result, 2 days later, when the Confederates' infantry reach the edge of Washington, they can see the newly completed Capitol Dome in the distance, and that same hour, Union reinforcements from the Sixth Corps are filing into the Washington defenses. Lew Wallace has saved Washington, and he's still in the political doghouse. It's politics were as important in the Civil War, or more so, than they are today. We forget that, too. But then Lincoln and Grant realize they've got to close down the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia as an invasion route, and they want to take away the ability of the valley to feed passing armies and to feed the Confederacy. It's really called the breadbasket of the Northern Confederacy. So Grant persuades Lincoln to let him send Philip Sheridan, this young, runty, foul-mouthed, ruthless, brilliant, charismatic Irishman, to take on Jubal Early. And the series of battles they fight, 3rd Winchester, Fisher's Hill, Tom's Brook, Cedar Creek, all but forgotten now. And Cedar Creek alone, the climactic battle in the Valley of the Shadow, it's one of the most dramatic, maybe the most dramatic battle of the Civil War. The characters, I mean, we forget them, not just Jubal Early and Sheridan, who are names that kind of echo, certainly with Civil War buffs they do. But you've got on the Confederates, when the Confederates get to the edge of Washington, one of the men looking at that Capitol dome and wearing a gray uniform is John C. Breckinridge, a former vice president of the United States, returning to Washington in a very different guise. In the battles, as you noted, on the Union side in the Shenandoah Valley, there are two future presidents. Rutherford B. Hayes, who was a very good president, forgotten now, history plays favorites. In the Civil War, he did not love war. He's a lawyer before the war and a budding politician and an ethical man. He's not attracted to war at all, but he goes to do his duty. And he does it well and honorably. His men love him. And he, in a terrifying moment on the third battlefield of 3rd Winchester, he makes the brave decision that saves the battle for the Union. He's an incredible man, but he's also mourning the loss of an infant to typhoid. He's put on the ballot for Congress back in Ohio, and he refuses to go back to campaign. He says, oh, even if you elect me, I am serving out the war in uniform. I'm not taking this uniform off until the war's over. And he's just an admirable man. Now, who talks about Rutherford B. Hayes? And he's the first president to try to reform the civil service. And he comes to power in the disputed election of 1876, the original Hanging Chads election. But he had made a promise when he campaigned after the war. He said, if elected to the presidency, I will serve one term and go home to Ohio. And he's a tremendously popular president. People want him to run again. They know he's a shoo-in if he does. And he said, no, I made a promise to the American people, and I will keep that promise. Dedicates the rest of his life to education reform and helping integrate slaves into society, former slaves into society. And so you have these wonderful men. You have this psychopathic young 24-year-old cavalry general, psychopathic in the term, in the sense that he really loved war, named George Armstrong Custer, fighting his West Point roommate, Tom Rosser, and John Brown Gordon on the Confederate side, one of the few who really come close to the ideal of the Southern Cavalier, although he's a bit of a hustler, too, and has one of the great love stories of the Civil War. So all these marvelous people, and still more, Sandy Pendleton, Stephen Dodson Ramsey, Jim Ricketts, James Ricketts, solid Union Division commander who, you know, just didn't look like the handsome, dashing guy you want, but a guy who fought solidly. All these wonderful characters, I want to bring them back to life. I want the American people to know more about their past, to get beyond the cliches, get beyond the tendentious history, whether it be right or left, and get at the facts and the wonderful personalities and not see these men as magic superheroes, because that demeans them. They were men who felt fear and dread and longing for home. They were physically tough. Many of these commanders, like Rutherford B. Hayes, suffered terrible wounds, came back to keep fighting. John Brown Gordon, same thing. They were tough men, truly devoted to their cause. And I'm talking your ear off, and I'll say one last thing before I let you speak. And that's it. One of my key goals is to get inside the heads of the time, to not dress 2015 psychologies up in 1864 uniforms or costumes. I want to understand them on their own terms and to be absolutely fair to these men. And so ideally, when you're reading about the Confederates, you should see things from the Confederate viewpoint and be rooting for them. When you're reading about the Union characters, you should be seeing it from their point and rooting for them. I want you to know and feel what these men believed, right or wrong by our standards. This is how they saw it. This is what they thought was worth 4 years of war and 750,000 dead.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ralph Peters, an award-winning and best-selling author whose latest novel, rooted in the Civil War, is called Valley of the Shadow. In your author's note at the end of this novel, you mention some of the important principles that are behind this book and some of the others that you have written. And you also talk about some of the, in a sense, advice that you discarded. And I think it's really interesting to think about this. One of them is that somebody who I believe knew something about about the Civil War, he thought that not only should you focus on the big names that everybody already knows, but to not write anything that would, in a sense, sort of sully the dignity or reputation of some of the most famous figures of the Civil War. But beyond that, you were also advised to not focus on anything from Gettysburg on, that in a sense the conflict is sort of a cleaner conflict earlier on, and one should avoid the latter stages of the Civil War, when of course the balance tips decisively towards the Union. I want you to talk a little more about what you think was prompting that bit of advice and why you have so emphatically discarded it. And of course, anyone who reads this novel will be so glad that you did. But I just wonder if you could just talk a moment about that advice and why, at least for you, it was very poor advice.
Well, and I did not take it, of course, but this was a very well-meaning person who had, you know, published a lot on the Civil War, and he was giving me advice that he believed to be true about how to be a commercial success. But for me, commercial success wasn't the important thing. You know, I can pay the bills. I'll do something else if I have to. What was important to me was to write something new. These truly authentic histories that looked honestly at the men, the battles, the environment. And I wanted to look at the battles and campaigns that had not been examined. I mean, you know, my first novel in this sequence of books was about Gettysburg, but even that was from this perspective of the immigrants, the privates, and the generals, too, but getting beyond the myths of Gettysburg. But to me, the important thing, again, is to look at the broader picture, to get at the real history. And to do that, it's not enough to just study the battles or the uniforms or that sort of thing. To me, it's also important to study the environment. And what were people reading? You know, beyond the songs of Stephen Foster or the known Civil War songs, what did they listen to? What did they really talk about? What were their concerns? What did things cost? What was it like on the home front? And you find like somebody like Rutherford B. Hayes, you know, this brigade and later division commander and still later a president, he's a very serious intellect. He has quite a library. He reads Ralph Waldo Emerson, the American transcendentalist philosopher. He wrestles with issues. He's a thinking man. And you have others, John Brown Gordon, on the Confederate side. He was a good scholar in Georgia at college. Because of family problems, he has to leave just before he graduates. He loves the classics. You know, he pictures himself as a sort of Ulysses or Odysseus. And when you really look into these men and their background and the complicated baggage, problems with debt on the home front, you know, how does my family get through this while I'm away? They become so much richer and more human. So in this book, Valley of the Shadow, and the other books I've written on the Civil War, yes, the gallant charges and desperate battles are there, but they're fought by, I hope, well-rounded characters and men and some women who are as real as I can make them. Because, again, pretending that they were flawlessly brave and never felt fear is nonsense. It insults them. It insults the courage they showed in rising above their fears. And so, again, I want these battles, campaigns, and men and moments to be as real for the reader and as authentic as I can possibly make them.
And I especially appreciated something you said in this author's note, again, speaking to the issue of choosing to write about the waning days of the Civil War when the Confederacy found itself in an increasingly desperate and even hopeless state. You write at one point, "It's an easy thing to be faithful and bold in victory, but their determination," meaning the Confederates, "to fight on as defeats piled atop one another is an indelible testament to the American character." I must say I'd never really stopped to think about it, and maybe it's because I'm from the North, but I don't think I've ever really stopped to think about that facet of the Confederates and the fact that what on the face of it might have seemed like foolishness, almost naivete, was in fact something else as they continued to fight what was increasingly a hopeless war against the Union.
Yeah, and it was so bitter. And so when I hear today, when I hear people, who history has been taken out of our schools. We don't teach it seriously. So you'll hear contemporary Americans saying, "Our country's never been so divided." Oh, really? I mean, these men, 750,000 died in the Civil War. They were willing to fight to the death. They were the Confederate infantry, they're starving. I mean, these guys are rail thin, bone thin, hard. They've got scurvy. They've got rickets. They've got lice. It's really an ugly war by the end. And nonetheless, when I look back, and again, you know, I have a Union Civil War ancestor. You know, my birthright was on the North. But when I look as a soldier, as a student at the Confederate infantry, especially the Army of Northern Virginia, if there was ever a better light infantry anywhere in history, I have yet to encounter them. I mean, certainly we've had great soldiers here and there around the world throughout the millennia, but those guys were incredible. And even Jubal Early's offshoot of the Army of Northern Virginia, this fight, the Army of the Valley he's leading against Sheridan, he's defeated by Sheridan repeatedly. But Sheridan consistently outnumbers him. three or more to one. And Early and his men just put up just these terrifically tough fights. The one thing, it's funny, I saw this in my own military career and training exercises and the like. One consistent thing is Americans initially don't react well to surprise. Very few people do. Very few soldiers of any army do. And so when the Confederates at Fisher's Hill are taken totally by surprise by an unexpected flank attack, in which Rutherford B. Hayes, again, plays a critical part, they fold. That's the one time that they really fold, unless they're being hammered on three or four sides by the Union, as at the close of some of the other battles. So it's just fascinating to see the continuities, but also the discontinuities. Again, the one crucial difference I see, and there are many psychological or sociological, I should say, differences between today, then and today, of course. And, you know, it gets you into, if you write about it honestly, it gets you into trouble with the politically correct crowd, but, you know, I'm going to write honestly anyway. But one thing is, these people were used to bearing a lot more pain than we are. I mean, this is the day before we even have aspirin. And you've got these officers who come back, they've got terrible wounds, the medical treatment of the day wasn't great, they've suffered badly, many are in constant pain, you know, they're in the field, they have toothaches. Diarrhea is dysentery, aggravated diarrhea is a terrible problem. Lee in 1864 at various times is suffering from angina, arthritis, diarrhea, indigestion, trouble digesting various foods. And he loves buttermilk, but he can't, it's too rich for him. And these people are, you know, they're waging this war by the last year or so, literally in constant pain. And these commanders, the names, you know, Barlow, Gordon, Rutherford B. Hayes, so many others, they're fighting in pain and barely recover from wounds that today would take them out of service completely. And we got one guy, and I'm writing now about the Petersburg Front and the next one in the Battle of the Crater. And one of the Union commanders in the crater, one of the brigadier generals, his name is Will Bartlett. He's a Harvard man. And he's lost a leg early in the war. He comes back to command with a cork leg. He's wounded twice more, pretty seriously, and he still commands. And at Petersburg, he's leading an infantry charge, hobbling along on his cork leg. In the crater, a mortar round blows off his cork leg. He's stuck there, and he's still leading his troops to the end. I mean, kind of hard to picture some of our present-day fellow Americans being that tough.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things about this book is, I'm sure this is true to a great extent in every one of these novels, is that you are sometimes in the position of bringing to life, so to speak, someone who is particularly complicated. And I think you say at one point that the person that was most difficult for you to capture in this novel was General Jubal A. Early. You write that he was an uncompromising, brave, difficult, hard to admire, yet somehow admirable man. Tell us more about this general. Now, this would be someone that to the average American is a largely unknown figure. I mean, not somebody nearly as well known as a Grant or a Sherman or a Lee. But you obviously found him to be an exceptionally compelling character and, as you just said, a challenging figure to capture in his complexity. Tell us more.
Yeah, well, old Jubal Early. I mean, he's actually a pleasure to write, but as well as a challenge, because he's such a vivid character. But here's a man that West Point trained, serves in Mexico, comes back, has a mediocre law practice in Southern Virginia. He's adamantly opposed to secession. He believes in the Union. He's still got loyalty to the old flag. Opposes it at the Richmond Convention. But when his state secedes, same with Robert E. Lee, Jubal Early volunteers to defend his state. While many of the political firebrands don't, they stay in politics. Well, Early, he's a real mixed bag from the start. He he's vocal in how he despises women, but he keeps a poor white concubine or mistress, whatever you want to say, back in Rocky Mount, and has several children by her. Just keeps it quiet, has her in a house up on the hill. In the Civil War, he's always complaining about his officers getting married and how marriage ruins them. But he rises through sheer spunk and fighting ability. He makes mistakes, as even the best generals do. And Lee sends him to the valley to fight because, as the Confederates who lead from the front are dying off, Early's the best he's got left for independent command. And again, Early keeps losing because he's outnumbered. But Lee and the Richmond papers savage him for losing. But Lee recognizes the odds he faces. When you're outnumbered 3 or 4, even 4 to 1, it's pretty hard to win. And Jubal Early does a creditable job. But he's an ornery, cranky guy. Early arthritis. He's bent over. He's big and hulking, but he's bent over. He's a tobacco chewer. And he's got, his beard is always ugly with tobacco juice running through it, except when he poses for photographs. He's spectacularly profane. He's got a temper. He's a guy who should never, you know, if he were alive today, you wouldn't want him on Twitter because he'd say nasty things he'd regret. And he's got this temper, and he manages to just say the wrong thing at the wrong time, insult people, he holds grudges, and yet he's not a bad man. He can sense it. He's a lonely guy. He's just never found his place. He wants to be admired, and, you know, he has a really love-hate or whatever you want to call it relationship with his best subordinate, John Brown Gordon, because Gordon is a classic, erect, handsome, dashing Southern Cavalier. You know, everybody admires Gordon. Soldiers love him, even though Gordon's a tough taskmaster. And Early's just kind of this, you know, big, hulking, ugly, foul-mouthed, tobacco-chawing guy. He doesn't have the charisma, that magic charisma that Gordon or Sheridan have. So, you know, writing about him, I went into the final research of the book, the final couple of years, thinking less of Early. But the more I studied him, the more I really looked at the battle in detail, the more I realized how complex he was. And he's really the kind of character I want to get at, not just the ones who are easy. I mean, Rutherford B. Hayes, I came to love that guy. And writing, I enjoyed writing about him. But he's one of those guys that's almost too good to be true. He's a truly ethical, noble spirit. Whereas Early is so much more complex. And I like to think I've come close to capturing him on the page and treating him fairly. Because that's one other thing we don't do. And historians are guilty of this. Certainly historical novelists are guilty of this. We do play favorites, and we caricature people. We sort of like the Gore Vidal approach. You make a light of them. You mock them. I'm not interested in mocking people. I'm interested in trying to understand them on their own terms. And so Valley of the Shadow, readers have to judge for themselves whether I succeeded or not. But of all the books I've written over a long career, Valley of the Shadow is the one where I felt that it really came together, where I got the voices right. I got the rhythm and the flow right. But again, that's for readers to decide.
I certainly would not take issue with that whatsoever. I think that is one of the things that makes this novel especially compelling. In some respects, a figure who we can draw in very sharp contrast to General Early, whom you've just described, is a future president of the United States, Rutherford B. Hayes, who comes across in your novel as a most admirable figure and someone who is a deeply sensitive individual and in some ways wise beyond his years, with a certain kind of mature perspective that was probably uncommon then and probably even less common now. Tell us more about how you shaped the General Hayes that we meet in this book and the kind of sources you drew upon to shed such intriguing light on his sort of personal self.
Right, Craig. Yeah, he does end the Civil War as a general, and most of the book he's a colonel. But Rutherford B. Hayes, again, history plays favorites. This man was a very good president, just an honorable, decent man. He comes out of Ohio politics, but he's that rare bird, a truly ethical politician. He doesn't want war by any means. Some of his best friends from Harvard Law are Southerners. He just dreads the thought of being cut off from those friends or what might happen to them. But when his country calls, he goes. And he starts out as a regimental officer, comes to command the regiment. Through sheer skill and bravery, he becomes regimental commander, brigade commander. Ultimately, on the battlefield of 3rd Winchester, he's thrust into division command in a desperate hour. But he's a man who's thoughtful. He reads. He has personal issues. He's devoted to his wife, Lucy. But he's not a liquor drinker or a hard drinker, but he likes the occasional beer. He's a man who loves to read. He's not today you have to be an extrovert to be a politician. He's really a bit more of an introvert, although he has a circle of friends. And his wife is a devout Methodist, and she just doesn't believe in drinking, but they have their little compromises on things. And he, in the war, when you get to this point in the war, he's mourning the loss of an infant to typhoid. His wife, as many wives did of officers, tries to follow him around whenever she can to join him in winter camps, and as a result of being in the camp, the infant gets sick and dies. And he's seen pain in his life as well. And when the war comes, he is not out for glory. He's absolutely not. And he even talks later in the war, when people are saying, they should have made you a general already. Why aren't you should protest? And he wouldn't dream of protesting lack of a promotion. And he said, I want to be one of the good colonels. And what he meant was he wanted to be one of the men who really did the fighting, who really led the troops, who really took care of them. And he does take care of his men. And later on, Rutherford B. Hayes, maybe some people know that he was a president, but we've just forgotten the guy. He comes to power, to the presidency, in the disputed disputed election of 1876, the original hanging chad election decided in Florida. And he had made a promise when campaigning. He said, if I am elected, I will serve one term and go home to Ohio. And he has to deal with the end of Reconstruction. He does everything he can for black education to soften the blow because the troops have to be withdrawn from the South. And he's the first president to try to reform civil service. We're still working on that today. He keeps the government out of the Great Railroad Strike until widespread destruction of property happens, and he feels compelled to move in. He's extremely popular with the American people. He would have been a shoo-in for re-election. Everybody wants him to run again. And he says, no, I made the American people a promise that if I were elected, I'd serve one term, and that would be it, and I'm going to keep that promise. He kept the promise, went back to Ohio, spent the rest of his life working educational reform and civic reform, and his favorite activity was holding reunions of his men. They would flock to these reunions. They revered him so much. But he did commit one dreadful act for which the European powers have never forgiven us. As president, in answer to his wife's beliefs, he banned liquor from the White House. And the diplomatic corps the European diplomats could not understand that at all. So I think they carried a grudge on that one.
Hmm.
Good man, good man.
Yes, you share some interesting things about him, and one of them, and this is the kind of thing where I'm really curious if you have kind of extrapolated this from all that you know about Hayes and what we know from the record, or if in some cases he has actually left behind him tangible, let's say, written evidence that in fact he saw the world as you described to us. For instance, you have him saying at one point, he could feel hatred. He could not feel hatred towards those across the lines. He would fight them and kill them because it was a necessity, because his cause was true, however scarred. But he could not, would not hate them.
That is absolutely true. That is Rutherford B. Hayes. Throughout the entire war, he's wondering about his friend, his best friend from Texas. He was not a hater. And, I've got to There's a wonderful biography of Hayes that I cite in the author's note. I try to always give credit and give, and when I can't list every book I use because I use hundreds, but some salient books for people to read if they want to learn more. And also, just there are some, you know, just some books that I thought were really, really good. But let me see if I can very, very quickly find that. Yes, the book, if you want to learn about Rutherford B. Hayes' Great American, So Nearly Forgotten, there's a book by Ari, A-R-I, Hoogenboom. It's called Rutherford B. Hayes, Warrior and President. And that is the best single source on Rutherford B. Hayes. But it's also a portrait of an era. It's a brilliantly done book. And so while I want people to buy my book, Valley of the Shadow, the Rutherford B. Hayes bio by Ari Hoogenboom is just terrific.
Hmm. Another observation made Colonel Hayes at one point, which I think is so poignant, it really got me thinking, was at some point when he shares or admits with some regret to the fact that that when he is in the thick of battle on the battlefield, that is where he feels the most alive. I wonder if you remember that moment in the book. And yeah. It's so poignant because it helps us realize that sometimes even those that are in a position of power and who on the outside might seem completely comfortable and confident, in fact, are harboring conflicted feelings which sometimes they themselves deeply regret.
Yeah, well, Hayes is a very thoughtful man, and he has, in this book, he has these discussions with his wife's brother, his brother-in-law, who's a doctor, who's a regimental and brigade surgeon, and that's a true character as well. And Hayes really, he is conflicted. I mean, he's not a war lover. He's not a man who's anxious to get into the battle. But ordered into the battle, he does his best, and combat is a captivating thing for many, many men. And he's a very effective leader on the field of battle. He doesn't lose his wits. He goes into that, you know, in the zone, as we'd say today. And so, you know, I'm trying to understand Hayes, and when I look at everything we know about him and everything he said, it must have been terribly conflicting. I mean, again, he's the opposite of George Armstrong Custer, who's in the book, of course. Custer loves war. Hayes does not. He wants it to be over. Custer would be glad if it went on forever.
I think a really interesting observation is also made at one point by a man by the name of Joe, and I'm trying to remember his last name, but he's often referred to in the book as Doc Joe.
Yeah, he's the brother-in-law of Rutherford B. Hayes.
Right, and he has very, very interesting observations about the military and life in the military, and at one point he says, "This army's a scheming, scrambling sock of scoundrels, angling for promotion at any cost. The only thing honor gets a man is killed." I really appreciate what he contributes to the flavor of this novel. Can you say a little bit more about this intriguing character and in a sense, why he's here? His presence adds.
Well, he's there because he was there. But Doc Joe, it's a curious thing with Doc Joe, the brother-in-law of Rutherford B. Hayes. They serve together. He patches Hayes up after his terrible wound in South Mountain. But when Hayes comes to the presidency, Doc Joe wants a specific appointment, and they fall out. They have a terrible falling out because Hayes won't appoint him. One, he doesn't think he's the best qualified man, and two, he doesn't want to be charged with nepotism. And it's a shame that things had to end between them that way. But in the war, now, we know a fair amount about Doc Joe from the studies of Hayes, but we don't know him as well. So that character, you know, I stick to the truth of the character as we know him, but I also, you know, using him as a foil to Rutherford B. Hayes. Hayes is the idealist. Doc Joe is the cynic. And also, once in a while, I'm having a little fun, too, with Doc Joe, because both armies were, we picture them as noble and perfect, both armies, North and South, were full of schemers, guys scheming promotions, scheming for advantage, trying to do the dirty on their fellow soldiers, cutthroat guys. And, you know, it's just amazing when you really look at the generals and the rivalries and the subterfuge. And there are two guys that are truly noble, like Robert E. Lee. I mean, he's obsessed with being a gentleman. It goes back to his family. His father's bankruptcy and shame shapes Robert E. Lee. And Robert E. Lee tries to live a life of rectitude in every respect, even in the formality of his diction. But back to Doc Joe. Yeah, Doc Joe is he has to be there as that foil for Hayes' idealism. So I was just fortunate that he really existed, because I wanted to use all real historical characters. And I was able to, including, of course, young Georgie Nichols of the 61st Georgia, a Confederate private who figures prominently in the book, who left us his own detailed record of what it was like to fight. I mean, he's a young boy, little guy, almost dies of dysentery, gets to the battlefield, and has quite a series of adventures.
Mm. The very last line of the book in the epilogue is this: this book is a call to remember. In our last minute or so, tell our listeners how this book is a call to remember. To remember what?
To remember what it cost to become the nation we can enjoy and live in amazing wealth and safety today. It's you know, 750,000 dead, but then the human stories behind those numbers, those raw numbers. This country, this wonderful country, for all its many flaws, its undeniable flaws, has cost a lot to build. It's cost a lot for a long time. It's always a work in progress, a work in being. And we still are in the tradition of those men and of their forefathers. And I hear the country is never so divided. Oh, my heavens. The American Revolution, almost half the population had Tory sympathies. The Jacksonian era, the Civil War, the Cross of Gold era, the Depression, the late 60s and early 70s when I was a teenager. I mean, we have been very divided through much of our history. And one thing, you know, at the end of the day, we can have these vigorous all-American political screaming matches, but at the end of the day, we need to remember we're all Americans. And those who came before us built this country for all of us in all our remarkable, sometimes uncomfortable diversity. So yes, it is a call to remember this hard, often brutal past that gave us the world we are privileged to live in today.
Hmm. The book is called Valley of the Shadow, the latest novel by Ralph Peters. It is published by Forge. Ralph Peters, I thank you so much for writing this truly marvelous novel and for joining me today on the morning show to speak so eloquently about it. I thank you so much.
I thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll spend part of the hour with a writer by the name of Nathan Sull, who has co-authored a very intriguing book called Simple Rules. It is the contention of these two writers that we live most successfully and happily when we confront various challenges and confront them by adhering to very basic and simple rules. And it's a very intriguing concept. I very much enjoyed this book and look forward to sharing this interview with you tomorrow. And on Thursday's morning show, we'll be speaking with a local psychologist who herself has struggled with certain mental illness issues. And it has informed the work that she does and inspired the writing of a very interesting new book. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information at carthage.edu. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Cloudy, breezy, and cool this morning. Sunshine by the afternoon, a high of just 56 degrees. This is WGTD HD.